of the ways in which the gut really influences biology from head to toe. And so what I'd like to do is just to share a little bit of that research and how the gut is so much more than just a digestive organ, important as that is, and how, as John alluded to earlier, what makes the gut so unique is that it really is an inner tube. And though maybe not the best graphic visualization after lunch, this is about a 26-foot inner tube that connects our mouth to our anus. And everything that passes through the gut is the outside world. What we call the lumen, the inside of the gut, is the outside world. It's very much inside us, but it's an external environment. And separating that external environment from this complex, beautiful human biologic environment is a one-cell-thick layer. One-cell-thick layer. You would think there'd be a bit more of a border defense, given the fact that this is really where the outside world meets the inside world. As John also alluded to this morning, virtually 75% of our immune system is poised just on the other side of that one-cell-thick layer. And it would make sense that you would want most of your defense system to be right there on the other side of the fence in the event anything that shouldn't be getting through ultimately gets through. So if anything, the gut is as much an immunologic organ as it is a digestive organ. And I think that if you take nothing more away from what I have to share with you this afternoon than that, I think that'll be a very helpful way to think about the gut. So we yesterday began to explore this fascinating relationship between our environment, how we eat and how we move and how we interpret and respond to stress and how we sleep and how we navigate the minefields of conflict in our lives. As Simone so beautifully alluded to this morning, whether or not we are likely to forgive in response to a prior hurt or transgression. And if anyone is interested in forgiveness research, I would highly recommend Fred Luskin, Luskin, Dr. Fred Luskin. He's at Stanford. He's done some amazing research on forgiveness and the neuroscience expression of a forgiving heart. And this environment, as we talked about yesterday, at many levels, powerfully influences our gene expression, how our book of life gets translated. And we explored a little bit, and we'll look at this more this afternoon, how the diversity of this fascinating ecosystem, our microbiome, in relationship to our environmental inputs and in its capacity to influence gene expression, really sets the stage for the biology that becomes our biography. And then there is, most importantly, right, this beautiful and complex and abstract and rarely studied aspect of the non-material representing 95%+ of the reality within which we exist. And in that context, we know that thoughts will influence the gut microbiome, will influence gene expression. We know that our emotions will significantly influence our microbiologic diversity, as it will gene expression. We know that loving relationships will significantly impact our microbiome and our gene expression. Love, perhaps the most powerful manifestation of consciousness in this embodiment, that this container that we inhabit on along this journey. And we also began to explore a holistic perspective on how these relationships, through food and movement and stress response and toxin management, sleep, social connection, many of the things that we've been exploring, ultimately, based on alignment with our book of life and our evolutionary biologic adaptation, will influence a handful of metabolic disruptors, all of which seem to be bundled and major drivers of chronic complex disease. And yesterday we talked a little bit about the inflammatory response in the context of these relationships, our immune systems that get turned on and get turned off, but for so many people are on most of the time. And so we'll explore, in the time that we have this afternoon, many of the mechanisms whereby inflammation is mediated at the level of the gut, and how gut permeability, or this leakiness, is a major driver of all of these things. Gut leakiness will certainly drive inflammation. The gut-brain connection, which is a powerful connection, very much will influence our stress response, mitochondrial disruption, etc. So again, from a systems biology perspective, the gut is so much more than breaking down food and helping us digest nutrients and eliminate that which we don't need. And all ancient traditions, I think, inherently understood that. Traditional Chinese medicine and Ayurvedic medicine. The gut is really the central point of emphasis from a human health and lifestyle perspective. But in Western medicine, the gut becomes an isolated organ system that is under the purview of the gastroenterologist. And rarely will the gastroenterologist talk to the rheumatologist or to the neurologist. Each expert in their oversight of a particular organ system the extent to which physicians who specialize communicate with each other is a good metaphor for our Western model, which is rarely do they communicate. And the current paradigm continues to be one that places these organs in a very separate domain with very little crosstalk. So much research now. This is just an exploding area of research. The gut microbiome. Every day you'll see several papers published. And all of this research is available on PubMed. I'm often struck when a skeptic approaches me and says, "Mark, you know, that all sounds pretty good, but I'd like to see the evidence." Most of the time I will try to provide them with evidence. But as soon as I hear that, I realize that their insight with respect to the evidence that exists is limited. And though I don't always say this, what I am thinking is, well, if you want to see the evidence, go get it. Do the work. Anyone can get onto PubMed and look at this. This is not some mysterious black box that nobody has access to. And what I see now is that many people are more empowered because of their ability and interest to access many of these very fascinating areas of research. But as John alluded to this morning, the extent to which this ecosystem drives so much of human health takes on even greater significance when you look at the fact that about 75% of the food in the Western diet is of limited or no benefit to the microbiota in the lower gut. And that's an understatement, because not only is it of limited or no benefit to the microbiota, it disrupts the microbiota. We've lost our legacy, a legacy that was once much more diverse and rich. And because most of our diet is comprised of, as John alluded to, I'm going to build on some of his remarkable insights this morning, because most of our diet is comprised of these refined carbohydrates, which get absorbed very early on in this 26-foot tube, inner tube of life. Very little of it reaches the large intestine where most of these microbes are, where they would do their fermentation, where they would be able to multiply and diversify and maintain some semblance of balance. So most of the food that they need is either of very poor quality or non-existent. And that right away becomes a major area of opportunity. Certainly from a caregiving perspective and from a self-care perspective. So as an ecosystem, and this number continues to grow, but there are well over 1,000 different types of organisms in our gut. You know, 4+ pounds of microorganisms. It's a universe of complexity and life. And we know that these organisms, the list continues to grow in ways in which they fundamentally support human health. Digestion is obviously an important issue. And if you look at the metabolism and obesity research, it is clear that there are certain patterns of microbial flora that will be more likely to extract more calories from food and to promote inflammation. And many people who struggle with their weight will have those microbiologic fingerprints compared to somebody who is lean and who is perhaps confronting less inflammation. And these organisms appear to train our immune system. They text message our immune system, and they give it suggestions in terms of when to ramp up and when to calm down. And as we talked about yesterday, when you look at immune systems that have gone rogue, we might call that asthma, we might call that life-threatening peanut allergy, we might call that ADD or ADDHD, we might call that autism spectrum. We're now seeing that from maternal microbiome to the early child microbiome, what the nutritional status of mom was, how much stress mom confronted, what the antibiotic load that mom received during fetal development, whether or not that child came into the world C-section or vaginally, whether or not that child was bottle-fed or breastfed, all of these sequential events ultimately determine in that child how well trained their immune system is. It would appear that the immune system of the fetus is developing and being trained long before birth. So this is a fascinating relationship. And the nature of this relationship, which is still in its, I think our understanding is still very much in its infancy, it's clear that we can modulate our immune system through the gut. And we're going to be talking about some strategies to do that, so that people who are experiencing more inflammation or autoimmunity will have many opportunities through lifestyle, nutrition, stress management, loving relationships, to alter the balance of this flora in the way that will modulate their immune system. Now, I've given a lot of medicines through the years to turn off the immune system. Most of that has been in serious inflammatory kidney issues, things that, you know, we call glomerulonephritis, or transplant. And you give folks prednisone, and you give them cyclosporin, and you give them Imuran. There are no shortage of powerful pharmaceuticals that can affect our immune system. The research is quite clear that we can do that even better and in a more balanced way through lifestyle and through attention to how this ecosystem is developed, diversified, and how the permeability of that one cell thick gastrointestinal epithelial cell layer maintains its integrity, where 75% of the immune system poised to respond is kept in check. So this is an enormously important aspect of the relationship between the gut and all aspects of human health. We also know this ecosystem is a powerful detoxification system. And we have many ways to detoxify through breath, through sweat, through urine, the kidneys. But the gut, and this is more than just eliminating, pooping out toxins. This is taking a molecule and changing the molecule in the way that will prevent it from getting reabsorbed back into the body. The gut ecosystem is brilliant in their capacity to recognize a toxin, to do something with that toxin, and to render that toxin inert. And that is a gift. And we need that system more than ever when you look at the burden of environmental toxins that we confront in our day-to-day lives. The other thing this ecosystem does is it helps us produce vitamins. Very importantly, many B vitamins are produced by gut bacteria. Vitamin K2, and I'm going to hope that John will elaborate a little bit on vitamin K2. It's one of the not so spoken about fat-soluble vitamins. And vitamin K2 is an extremely important vitamin in terms of helping the body put calcium where calcium needs to be put. People with coronary artery disease or cerebrovascular disease have very calcific arteries, arteries that become stiff, they don't have much compliance, they become narrow. Many of those people are vitamin K2 deficient. K2 takes calcium, puts it in bone, takes it out of our blood vessels where it doesn't belong. And we're now beginning to see that vitamin K2 deficiency, in part dietary related, because many K2 is largely in fat-soluble foods like butter and, you know, full-fat dairy, but also requires a balanced ecosystem for adequate fermentation and production of this. There are many other healing metabolites. John alluded to this morning the short-chain fatty acids that emerge from fermentation of accessible and good quality fiber. And these messengers, as John alluded to, do many things. Butyrate, this 4-carbon fatty acid that occurs from fermentation of quality fiber that makes its way to the colon, the large intestine, is a major anti-inflammatory molecule. It also is now known to affect insulin. It lowers insulin levels. It's also known to affect methylation patterns of the human epigenome. A molecule that emerges in the context of a relationship between quality fermentable fiber and a diverse microbiologic ecosystem becomes essential in altering gene expression. It's another emerging example of how the microbiome, our environment and our inputs, and our epigenetic gene and translation book of life ultimately interact. And then there are many hormones, from sex hormones, estrogen metabolism, and estrogen dominance is very much influenced by the quality and diversity of this ecosystem. And there are many other hormones, some of which I'll allude to, that this system impacts. And when you look at the sheer prevalence of inflammatory health issues, and who doesn't have some of this? And if you're in America, you have many of these things. Most people with allergies will have some evidence of gut permeability or dysbiosis. People that have weight-related issues, and I see people all the time that they're making a lot of remarkable changes, many of which are quite helpful. But until you fully address the gut, it's very hard to gain traction in losing weight and maintaining a healthier weight. We know that reactive airway disease or asthma is very much of an inflammatory lung manifestation that is influenced by what is happening in the gut. Go figure. There are certainly things in the air that will trigger asthma. But consider the fact that slight alterations in the balance of the human microbiome will determine how well an individual can breathe. Autoimmunity, and we talked a little bit about autoimmunity. Like all of these things, autoimmunity has become an epidemic. 2016 statistics, about 25 million Americans have autoimmunity, from rheumatoid arthritis to celiac, to multiple sclerosis, to Crohn's disease, to ulcerative colitis, to lupus, psoriasis. These are autoimmune diseases that continue to go up. And if you have an autoimmune disease and you go to your doctor will say, you have an autoimmune disease, it's genetic, you were handed a bad card, we don't know where it comes from, but you've got the card, And here are some medications that you can take to suppress your immune system, to turn it off. And that can be really helpful in suppressing symptoms. These medications can save lives. But these are not smart drugs. They don't know when the immune system should be turned on or turned off. They just turn it off. So when you look at the side effects of many of these immune suppressive drugs used to treat autoimmunity, they can create life-threatening infections. Because if you're exposed to a pathogen and your immune system can't manage it, that could quickly become life-threatening. There's a much higher incidence of cancer. Because as John has alluded to, it's our immune systems that identify rogue cancer cells that are circulating all the time. We hope they never manifest. And one of the reasons they don't manifest is because our immune systems are sufficient enough to identify them and eliminate them. So people on chronic immunosuppression drugs have much higher incidences of cancer. So there are powerful trade-offs. And hopefully you'll take away some context and opportunities for how one can better manage this in a way that might limit or reduce the need for some of these more potent drugs. Arthritis, rheumatoid arthritis, which is a type of autoimmunity, certainly very prevalent. We know metabolic bone disease, osteoporosis, very much linked to gut health. Who would have thought? Tremendous issue for many people. Eczema, psoriasis, rosacea around the nose. These are all gut-related issues. Mood disorders, also just prevalent. You know, 1 out of 4 American adults will experience significant depression in their lifetime. 1 out of 4. And, it's just, who doesn't know someone or who themselves isn't confronting this? We now know that if you take a stool sample, this is called a fecal transplant, from somebody whose mood is good, and you transplant that stool sample, and the current way that is being done is you make an enema out of it. You mix it up, a little fluid, put it in a syringe, up the rectum. In a relatively short time, the mood of the recipient of that microbiome will begin to improve. I mean, that's kind of a phenomenal thing to consider. And there are many other examples of fecal transplant. The most common and most research is for what is called C. difficile colitis. Have any of you ever heard of that? This is a life-threatening infection, almost exclusively picked up in hospitals, in people who are sick and who get lots of antibiotics that totally obliterate the normal microbiome. It allows this Clostridium, this type of organism, and John alluded to Clostridium and its relationship to autism. Clostridium will create very severe and is often fatal complications for people. If you give those people a stool sample from an otherwise healthy host, that C. difficile disappears, generally within 24, 48 hours. There's a lot of evidence now that Alzheimer's and the most common cause of dementia, while it has many influences, will frequently have aspects of the gut that are not in balance. Same with cancer. So when you begin to see these patterns, when you begin to connect the dots, you can see how the gut and the immune system and the mitochondria and the stress response become fault lines, which all become interconnected. And that if the alignment of the environmental inputs and the gene epigenetic predisposition and the microbiologic diversity and the polarity of one's consciousness, whether it is more positive and loving or not, will become the perfect storm of a life that may be profoundly challenged, or one that seems to thrive and live long and well. So this is a kind of a summary of where the bacteria are located. Again, our small intestine which connects our stomach to our colon. Our large intestine is the longest part of our intestinal tract. But there aren't many organisms in our small intestine. Very few. And if you look at the stomach and the duodenum and the jejunum, which are small intestine, as you go downstream and get closer to the colon, you see more organisms. But if you compare the colon to the stomach or to the small intestine that is very near the stomach, there are many orders of magnitude difference of the numbers of organisms present. This is not an accident. Nature has created a symbiosis that has strategically populated these organisms where they tend to best support our health and wellness, and where we best support their health and wellness. What is good for them is good for us. What is good for us is good for them. And if, again, I alluded to some of this, but when you look at these commensal bacteria, they certainly help us manage pathogens. They can help with nutrient needs. They can keep other bacteria in check by virtue of, again, balance. They help with what's called this mucus layer. John alluded to this mucus layer, which is really this very important thick layer that lines the surface of these cells. It's an important barrier. And people with leaky gut have a breakdown of that mucus barrier, which leads to a separation of the epithelial cells, which then allows things to pass through. And when you begin to lose diversity, this mucus protective layer starts to break down. The bacteria also help with the promotion of IgA. This is an antibody that's produced exclusively in our mouths and in our gut. It's kind of a first defense system. And if that isn't sufficient, the defense system throughout our body gets called into action. And as I said, they really train our immune system. These organisms are the teacher of our immune system. And sometimes I wonder, you know, who truly is more sophisticated? Bacteria adapt quickly to the environment they're in. They've been here long before we arrived. They will be here long after we exit. We are visitors on their planet. And then you look at various metabolic functions. They will, with balance, keep our epithelial cells healthy. And if that system goes awry, colon cancer becomes a greater risk. Did you have a question?
No.
Yep. Yes. Conventional wisdom was that the uterus was a sterile environment. Evidence now would suggest that you do see early signs of colonization in utero. Most of it, though, appears during the birth process and in the first few years of life. That's where the majority of the microbiome in a child is formed. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure our ancestors had problems with leaky gut. If you look at the microbial diversity of in ancestral cultures compared to Western cultures, and a lot of this research has been done by Jeff Leach, who's done a lot of research in Tanzania with the Hadza, and he's looked at multiple generations of Hadza by looking at their stool samples, and they have a much greater diversity of organisms than what you see in Western people. And when you look at certainly at their lifestyles, and you know, as we continue to emphasize a wide diversity of plant-based foods that they consume, tremendous amounts of fiber, on average greater than 100 grams a day of fermentable fiber. You know, the average American might consume 10 grams a day. So undoubtedly they had problems along the way. I think the suggestion to me is that through the ways in which they ate, the ways in which they live, they were able to and have been able to create a much more diverse symbiotic relationship with these organisms that protect their gut in ways that make many of those inflammatory conditions extremely unusual. It's unusual to see autoimmunity in those individuals. Same is true in the Okinawans and, you know, many of these blue zone inhabitants. So I can only assume that from an evolutionary biologic perspective, that relationship was nurtured in a way that enhanced the survival of both species. And, you know, we've become disconnected with many of those relationships. And as I mentioned, you know, these organisms help with these short-chain fatty acids. This is butyrate and acetate and propionic acid, as John alluded to. And they're very important in the synthesis of vitamin K2, biotin. You know, these are B vitamins, folate, as you know. And there are many different, these are genuses of bacteria. You know, there are several different genuses. And I think the key here, you know, John alluded to Klebsiella, a very important organism. This is about balance. We all have Klebsiella. The question is, what is the representation of this relative to other species in the gut? And Klebsiella has been a bit unique in its relationship to autoimmunity. People with rheumatoid arthritis have much more Klebsiella in their guts. People with autoimmunity in general. And John alluded to, you know, Clostridium. Alone, there is nothing inherently pathogenic about these organisms. It's really their relationship with each other and the ecosystem that they inhabit. Yes?
I guess it's important for that single layer to be very thin because there's a lot of good things that need to go. I mean, it's important that it's perfect.
Yes. Great, great point, Simone. I mean, from an absorptive capacity, if you look at the surface area of the intestinal tract, you know, if you were to fillet it open and spread it out, it would probably cover a doubles tennis court. Tremendous surface area. So that one cell thick, broad surface area gives humans tremendous absorptive capacity. With intestinal tracts that over evolution became shorter, perhaps in a way that would allow us to commit more energy to brain development compared to other species. So that is an extraordinarily important structural aspect of the gut and its capacity to help us get as much as we can from that which we consume. Thank you. And this is just another schematic of this one cell layer thick epithelium, as we refer to it. So this side here is, we call it the lumen. This is the space that runs through our bodies, the inner tube. We have this one cell layer thick protection. What you don't see here would be a mucus layer. That would be right along this side here. And then just on the other side are many different types of immune cells. And when these cells start to come apart, John alluded to zonulin. Zonulin is a protein that, when expressed, will lead to separation of these cells. And in 100% of people who consume gluten, this is Alessio Fasano's research at Mass General Hospital in Boston, will have upregulation increases of zonulin and will be at risk for gut permeability. Now, it may be that one of zonulin's roles is to say, you know, there's something that I'm looking at here. I'm not sure if it's friend or foe. I would like the Army to take a closer look at it. And one way that the Army can take a closer look at it is for there to be some separation which will allow that questionable exposure to be surveyed by our defense system. That's just a theory. But the point is that once this has been breached, organisms, pieces of organisms that we call lipopolysaccharide, John alluded to that this morning, or gluten, or a poorly digested and broken down protein, like wheat germ agglutinin, gets through. Our immune system's well designed. They say, oh, that doesn't belong here. Some of these cells have the role of taking it and presenting it. The presenting cell takes it and then shows it to the immune system and says, what do you think? Our immune systems are pretty intelligent. They say, oh, that's really not very familiar. They then stimulate the rest of the troop to come in and produce all of these inflammatory mediators. We call them cytokines, C-Y-T-O-K-I-N-E-S. It's an orchestra of proteins that ramp up quickly our immune defenses. So you can appreciate that there's a relatively fine line between potential foreigners and a system that is poised to respond. And I would make the case that what is introduced into our gut now looks very different than what our ancestors had introduced to their guts. And not just by way of modern processed foods, but molecules like glyphosate and Roundup, or antibiotics that are used so frequently now in modern life, or pesticides or herbicide residues, or medications that are new to nature, medications that didn't exist a few generations ago. So when you do kind of a quick list, and John really set the stage this morning, of things that will enhance this permeability, this trafficking. When I'm around physicians, rarely do I use the term leaky gut. It's just so unscientific. So I say intestinal barrier function becomes disrupted. And I say, oh, yeah. That's a real concern. You know, if I say leaky gut, they say, where's the evidence? I get them some papers, but again, I'm thinking, do the research, you knucklehead. There's more than enough evidence there. That's a cop-out, in my humble objective opinion. So many people are sensitive to foods. And it's not that there's necessarily something inherent in the food that they've always been sensitive to. I've seen people who go into the hospital for surgery. Let's say they're going to get their gallbladder out. And bless you. And they get an antibiotic. If you have surgery, you're going to get a dose of intravenous antibiotics. That is the standard of care. It's to prevent post-operative infections. And evidence would suggest that that is a very effective way of reducing post-operative infections. But the unintended consequence of that is you're going to have a wholesale shift in your microbiome. That person may notice post-operatively that there are certain foods that they're sensitive to that they were not sensitive to preoperatively, probably a consequence of some alteration of their gut dysbiosis on the basis of something they received. Or a person may have a traumatic event, a divorce, loss of a loved one, losing their job. Something happens here, it alters something here, it expresses itself here, and rarely can one connect those dots. Rarely from a physician perspective do those dots get connected. I've had people tell me that they don't tolerate certain foods after the loss of their spouse. So we know that these are complex interactions, but many food sensitivities are a consequence of alteration of the ecosystem itself, so that a food that may be a particular problem at one point in time may not be a problem at another point in time, contingent on many of these factors: sleep quality, stress management, changes in diet, alterations of medications. Very dynamic, very complex, very interconnected. John spoke a lot about lectins, and again, there's nothing I could add to what he said, other than that many people, for example, who maybe feel worse on gluten and feel better when they eliminate gluten aren't necessarily gluten sensitive. Gluten may be a surrogate for the lectins that are contained in that particular grain, or the carbohydrate density of that particular grain that is altering the gut flora. So alone, these may or may not be problems, but in the context of multiple things, for some, you can add up to a point of beginning to have problems. Dysbiosis is simply a loss of balance of the ecosystem. That's the most simple definition. And there are two ways that that expresses itself. One is that you have far fewer organisms. So compared to the Hadza in East Africa, who may have 1,500 different species of organisms, compare that to a Western European or an American who may have half that amount. Less diversity. That is one way that dysbiosis manifests. The other way is that of those species present, there are some that predominate. There's a predominance of Klebsiella. There's a predominance of, and the, you know, the names aren't that important, Prevotella. There's a predominance of Clostridia, which ordinarily would be kept in check by other members of the community. A diverse gut ecosystem is a very effective democracy. But once you have anarchy, you know, with a few rogue types of organisms, you can quickly begin to lose that balance. So that's really what dysbiosis is. Now, John talked about SIBO. This is small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. And it's a type of dysbiosis where the bacteria, which are mostly in the colon, as you recall from that few slides ago, migrate upstream. These organisms find themselves in the small intestine in much higher quantities than they were intended to be. And it's increasingly clear, as John alluded to, almost 75% of Americans have evidence of SIBO. And presence of bacteria upstream in the gut will perhaps promote more sensitivity to food because of these inflammatory responses, will definitely enhance the permeability of the lining of the gut, which will lead to a more robust immunologic response. Inflammation will result in what might be experienced as reflux. The more organisms that we have migrating up, the more likely we are to experience reflux. Reflux is considered to be a problem with too much acid produced. And when too much acid is produced, it migrates into the esophagus, and it's nasty. You get heartburn. When I had a poor diet, I had horrible reflux. And when I cleaned it up, it went away. It was a revelation. SIBO really doesn't have so much of an impact on acid. What it does is it creates more gas from fermentation, which creates more pressure in the gut. You might experience that as bloating, you know, gas, belching. And it's that pressure that allows the acid in the stomach, which isn't being overproduced. The problem is it's not staying in the stomach. As that pressure builds up, things tend to go retrograde. So ordinarily things flow in a forward direction, but if pressure begins to build up because you've got increased fermentation, gas production, inflammation that is beyond the stomach, that will retrograde, transmit to the stomach, And that acid that the stomach produces will then go into the esophagus, which you experience as heartburn. And as I'll show you in a moment, if you look at how we treat that with these proton pump inhibitors, which turn acid off in the stomach, and people do feel better, you end up having the opposite effect than that which you intended. Proton pump inhibitors are really good for reflux, Dr. Pettis. The evidence is quite clear on that. You know, here's the evidence. Here's the randomized control data. It will reduce the acid, but that is not the problem. And as it turns out, that these proton pump inhibitors, because they reduce acid production in the stomach, acid being one of the great protectors of migration of bacteria into the small intestine, you end up actually making SIBO worse. So the treatment for the symptom, namely heartburn, disrupts the ecosystem in a way that makes it almost impossible for the person to get off the proton pump inhibitor, because you've now worsened the underlying conditions that led to the reflux in the first place. Which is why anyone who's ever been on a proton pump inhibitor, these were initially approved for 4 weeks of treatment. I see people who say, geez, you know, Dr. Pettis, I started my Nexium, the purple pill, in 2006. I've been on it for 10 years. For the most part, it keeps my reflux in check. It is almost impossible for that person to get off their acid inhibitor because they've got so much dysbiosis and so much SIBO that quickly manifests until you deal with some of these underlying causes for those problems. Yes?
Maybe you're going to address this, but testing for SIBO, I've been told, is difficult.
Yes.
And then isn't part of the treatment antibiotics? Or is that just what?
Yes. Yes and yes. Very testing is challenging, and accuracy is, you know, the sensitivity of accuracy of breath testing is limited. And I am going to talk about that. But when positive, the treatments are antibiotics that they don't get absorbed systemically, but they tend to target the specific overgrowth organisms that lead to the inflammatory and dysbiotic symptoms. Those treatment effects, and I'll cover what they are effective about 50% of the time. So the diagnosis is tricky, the treatment is not very effective, and when people do respond, often they have relapses. They may feel better for about 6 months, and then the SIBO comes back. So all of that is to say, like most things, until you deal with the underlying causes, any pharmacologic treatment is going to give you a limited outcome. SIBO is really tricky, and I think we have a lot more to learn about it from a testing and a treatment perspective. Helicobacter pylorus, H. pylori, is not what I'm referring to when I refer to SIBO. H. pylori is the presence of H. pylori is an interesting organism that can reside in the stomach, that is associated with reflux, and can be associated with gastric cancer, and the treatment of which is usually an antibiotic and a proton pump inhibitor. That is another area where I think there's a lot of confusion and conflicting information in terms of H. pylori's role in reflux. Some people clearly get better when you eradicate H. pylori. How do you know they have it? You go in with a scope, you biopsy the stomach, you grow the organism, you eliminate the organism, and a person feels better. That would fulfill what is known as Koch's postulates. You think you've got the problem, you've diagnosed it, you eradicate the problem, the symptoms are better. There has to be some cause and effect there, and there probably is. What's interesting about H. pylori is that there are many indigenous people that have H. pylori that are totally asymptomatic and may have protection from H. pylori. So, and I don't know if you have comments, John, but I think for me, what the uncertainty with H. pylori is it possible that H. pylori, when acquired at a younger age, may become a more effective commensal organism that helps us, but when acquired at a later stage in life, may be more pathogenic? And I don't think we know the answer to that. Do you have any additional thoughts on that, John?
Well, we do know that when H. pylori is eradicated, that in many cases, a person's risk for developing asthma is greatly increased. So there's definitely a protective role there, and the acquisition at a young age may be the important determinant, or it could be the role of other microbes further downstream that collectively work almost in symbiosis with H. pylori. But when you have a loss of diversity, as Mark's been describing, that H. pylori on its own could be more pathogenic.
Yeah, these are really great questions and really good comments. And I think we're just scratching the surface of some of these relationships. Much of the research that has looked at flora has looked at cultures. We know that those are not the most specific way to identify flora. Now you can do DNA testing, what's called PCR, polymerase chain reaction. It's more accurate. But that's done on a stool sample. And there's uncertainty as to whether what's in a stool sample represents what might be in your colon, what might be in your intestine. We think there's correlation, but we don't know that for sure. So I think we have a lot more to learn about this. Yes, Judy.
Isn't there a blood test for H. pylori?
Yes. The question was, is there a blood test for H. pylori? And the answer is yes. And really, you're looking at the antibody. You're looking at the immune system producing an antibody for that. I would say that there is limited sensitivity of that test. In other words, people with H. pylori don't always have an antibody that is measurable in the blood. And there are people who can improve from H. pylori, for example, with eradication, where you will see persistence of that antibody, which won't tell you anything about whether you've eradicated that disease or whether there's a relapse. There is a stool test, which is probably more sensitive and specific for H. pylori. And so generally, I would start with a stool test. I think the gold standard is an upper endoscopy with a biopsy and culture. And endoscopies are often helpful because people with reflux are at risk for what's called Barrett's esophagus, which can be a risk for esophageal cancer. They might have an ulcer, so that visualizing can give you more information in addition to just the biopsy and the culture. The current standard of care,
yes,
is that if you are symptomatic, uh-huh, with what we call either reflux or dyspepsia, which is gas, pain, discomfort, usually after eating. So if you are symptomatic and you have H. pylori by endoscopy, the current standard of care is to eradicate it.
How do 80% of
it? Yes. Right. Yeah, I mean, if somebody is asymptomatic, I wouldn't even think about H. pylori. And whether someone who is symptomatic and has H. pylori should have assertive eradication, I don't know. That's the current standard of care. And those people will get better. And there may be a reduction. If somebody has Barrett's esophagus, if they have a concerning gastric ulcer, eradicating it will certainly reduce the risk of cancer. But, you know, for the majority of people, that's probably not going to be the natural history of the presence of H. pylori. Yes? Are we going to go back to SIBO again? What would you like to know about SIBO?
Well, I feel very unsatisfied placebo. I mean, and I know she's using those antibiotics instead of overall. I mean, as a theory, like, well, because I'm sure I have some, I suspect that. I just eat healthy for a while. I mean, would those critters leave there?
Yeah, so, you know, I think there are a lot of people researching SIBO. Mark Pimental at Cedars-Sinai, I think, is at the vanguard of a lot of the SIBO research. We still have incomplete understandings of diagnosis of SIBO. We have incomplete understandings of SIBO as an overgrowth of bacteria versus a motility problem. The motility of the small intestine being impaired. They may coexist, they may not. I think that's right now an incomplete understanding. And certainly many of the treatments, which are worth pursuing, do, at least at this point in time, seem to have relatively low cure rates with very high relapse rates. So is SIBO worth looking for? Absolutely. Will testing totally exclude it if it's negative? No. If positive and you're treated, will that guarantee resolution? No. I mean, that would be my summary of the current state of the art. The gold standard for diagnosing small intestinal bacterial overgrowth is to take a 15-foot small silastic catheter, place it through your nose, and get into the distal small intestine and biopsy. No studies do that. That's the gold standard. Most of the studies that are published are based on breath testing. And the way breath testing works is you take a sugar in a drink and you drink that. And if there are a lot of bacteria in your small intestine, they will ferment that sugar quickly, within 30 minutes to an hour, usually, of taking that drink. Fermentation produces two things that are measured. Historically, you would just measure acid, called the breath test, the acid breath test. There's now recognition that many organisms that seem to be involved in SIBO may not be acid-producing organisms. We call them methanogens. They produce methane. So one problem with testing is you need to make sure the lab is measuring both acid and methane in your breath. Ordinarily, because these organisms should be more distal, within 30 minutes to an hour after drinking the sugar, you would not be producing this because it would take more time for them to get into the colon to be fermented to produce those metabolites. So seeing that in a short time is the current standard for diagnosing SIBO. The challenge is not all labs measure both methane and acid. If they turn positive, treatment is certainly worth pursuing. And I do have a slide that, you know, the treatment is, and again, this is sort of the standard Western approach, is to take two antibiotics. One is called rifaximin or xifaxan. The other is neomycin. If you have a positive breath test and you take xifaxan and neomycin, about 75% of those people will then have a negative breath test. About 3 out of 4. That's not too bad. If you then re-breath test those people at 6 months, the majority will be positive. At least 50% of those that initially respond will turn up positive down the road. They may not be symptomatic. So I think right now it's... Right.
That's really
important. Yeah. So I testing is incomplete. Treatment is incomplete. It's an important thing to think about. But I think this right now is much more art than science.
What's the speed test called? Is there a name for it? They're going down the tube?
Yeah. I mean, nobody does that. I mean, I would not volunteer to have that done. And most gastroenterologists would not want to do that. I mean, it would be called small intestinal intubation. you know, with a biopsy, and then you culture those organisms, that would be the gold standard. In other words, that would more accurately than anything reflect what is actually growing down there. But it's so invasive that the breath test has become the current standard. Yes? Can acid and methane give you bad breath? They can. Many people that have bad breath will have it on the basis of dysbiosis in their mouths and in their small intestine. And the combination of the foods that they eat and the organisms in those places and the gases that are produced on the basis of that fermentation can cause bad breath, for sure. It can, yes. Well, it can come from both places, but there, for many people, it is a small intestinal origin. Yes.
Yeah. I just want to share a brief personal story about my husband, to whom I've been married for more decades than you can imagine. As long as I was married to him, I would say, the first 3.5 decades, he was a very healthy guy, very athletic, but he had IBS, dyspepsia, migraines with a sick stomach, reflux, and Hashimoto's, for which he wasn't treated, but they...
Marianne, I'm going to just hold this while you talk.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, my husband was a healthy guy who had, you know, a lot of these things. This was his cluster. He didn't really have other things except he was on blood pressure medication. And it's the most amazing thing on earth. He has none of these anymore. I mean, he probably still has Hashimoto's, but he's doesn't need any thyroid. He's never been on thyroid medication. You know, he had endoscopies. He was on proton pump inhibitors. He hasn't had a migraine with a sick stomach in, I would say, 8 years. He doesn't have reflux anymore. I mean, you know, it's really phenomenal because this really dominated his, you know, annual physicals. It was just part of who he was. I never really thought too much about it. I just assumed that's the way he was. And we don't, for the life of us, know precisely out of all the things that comprise a lifestyle. I did see something recently on mast cells, and mast cells are on the surface of the immune system, and there's something called mast cell activation that can have this particular constellation of symptoms. So I don't know if his mast cells were activated and somehow, I wish I could say it was something I did, but I can't. Anyway.
Yeah, so I think this is a great discussion, and certainly there'll be nothing in the research that will allow satisfactory reconciliation of some of these challenges. But I think that the point that we'll continue to make is that the single most important way to approach SIBO is by eliminating sugar, fructose, and carbohydrate-dense foods. That is ultimately what allows these organisms to propagate. Some people do have motility problems, and that may be best on a particular burden of stress, or may be aggravated by other additional medications like these anti-inflammatory medications, or may be propagated by, you know, a pesticide or glyphosate, something that's interfering with the host response, the normal commensal organisms. So. Far more questions than answers with respect to SIBO. I think the point is that this is an alteration of the ecosystem that, while breath testing and treatment, I think, is an important consideration, it really should be in the context of a alteration in diet that will diminish the substrate for these organisms to grow in the first place, while at the same time providing healthier sources of fermentable fiber that will allow those commensal organisms that are often insufficient to grow to keep these other organisms in check. So that these proton pump inhibitors can be very disruptive because of their inhibition of acid, which takes away a defense that ordinarily would allow or prevent organisms from migrating upstream closer to the stomach. It also allows an inhibition of acid that will interfere with more effective digestion, breakdown of protein, some of which proteins may be presented to the immune system in ways that appear more threatening than they would if they were fully broken down. So I do think that while this is often used to treat gastrointestinal symptoms, it unintentionally becomes a provocateur of the underlying causes or origins of those symptoms. And we know that these non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, these anti-arthritic medications, which can be really effective, particularly if they're just being taken for, you know, a couple of days or periodically for, you know, an arthritic issue or a low back strain, when taken regularly, they will break down that barrier and they will break down that mucosal protective layer, and it will begin to allow this migration of lipopolysaccharide and will promote the permeability of the gut.